everybody. Welcome to Who Cares About the Rock Hall, a podcast about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm your host, Joe Quazala. I know too much about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It is my curse, my burden. But at this time of year, it serves me, I think. I think people maybe look to me for some sort of strange expertise. Anyway, with me as always is my co-host. She is the voice of the people, the little devil on my shoulder, Kristen Studdard. How are you, Kristen?
Hello, I'm pretty good. Wearing devilish red today ready to do. Also, I don't do any preparation and I have no idea what we're talking about today, which is exciting for me.
Let us remind the audience and our guest, really, that you come in relatively blind. You are probably guessing that we are starting our nominee based episodes.
Yes.
Which we, you know, do annually once the ballot drops. And so let's bring in our guest. He's an author who's written about many subjects with an emphasis on Texas, whether that means books about the Dallas Cowboys, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Selena, or Willie Nelson. Joe Nick Potosky. Welcome, Joe.
Hi. Thank you, Joe. How are you guys doing?
We're doing okay. We're in the throes of ballot season, which is exciting for our show. It's the most excitement that our show gets. And then after everything happens, we wait around for 6 months. But right now, we have something to talk about.
Yeah.
You've never been on the show before. Our listeners do not know you. And so I want to get an idea of who you are with some questions. We'll start with just, you know, the Rock Hall is a peripheral entity for a lot of people. It's not something that a lot of people know about, certainly not as much as I do. But what's your reference level for the Rock Hall?
Well, my reference level is being aware of it. And then in 2016, actually visiting the Rock Hall and getting to go through the stacks in the back and look at all the research tools that are available. While I screened a film that I directed on a musician named Doug Somm, Sir Doug and the Genuine Texas Cosmic Groove. And despite the fact Doug Somm should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and isn't, I'm still open to all possibilities and still have a lot of hope. But I had a great time going up there and getting the full treatment and seeing what it's like. And I actually had the benefit of a few months earlier, I'd screened the film at the Country Music Hall of Fame in Nashville. So I kind of compared apples and oranges, mm-hmm. the music. They're both pretty dedicated places. And they both have these great research wings. For people like me, if I had a subject that I needed to dig into, I would be going back to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and losing myself in your stacks.
Right. We've heard that from a few authors that, you know, kind of the secret sauce of the hall is that you can go and access these archives and they have so much information, so much you could do research wise that is really invaluable.
It was great, and I just haven't had a chance or a reason to come back and abuse your hospitality and the hall's hospitality. They said come on back and do something. I just haven't had a subject that I've needed to come back and go to, but it's great. I mean, up until the 90s there was nothing representing rock and roll, and you know, Country Music Hall of Fame has had several decades jump on the ball, mm-hmm. but it's, you know, both are, to me, as someone who's made a career out of writing about music, they are probably two of the most important institutions in music, as far as I'm concerned. So it's y'all do the Lord's work, and I appreciate what you do.
LOL.
And
I appreciate whoever
Nominated and considered Willie Nelson. It's another one of those that, you know, I'm a cranky old music writer. So it's like, there's always, it's about time. Well, Willie's about time. So I'm glad he's nominated. And I have all expectations he will be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, that's a wise thought. We're with you on that one.
Yeah, we definitely the second part for sure. It's interesting that you're giving us credit as though we are the hall. We are now figureheads as well for the hall, Joe.
Yeah,
association. I'm sorry.
I suppose, but yeah, at this point, 5 years in, you know, we certainly know it. We know a lot of people. Do we have an impact? Do we have any influence? That's up for debate. But let's look at this year's ballot. And as a means of getting to know you.
Boy, that's a loaded question.
Well, you know, let's pretend like you're a voter. A voter gets the ballot. They can choose up to five names off of this ballot, and they don't have to choose five. I mean, if you wanted to, and this would be revealing of your character potentially, you could say I'm voting for Willie Nelson and nobody else, and I'm putting my ballot in. But looking at this ballot, what would you do and how would you choose?
You know, I would say just look, I've been writing about music for over 50 years professionally. And so my opinions, my take on rock and roll is fairly Catholic. And, you know, it's very distinct. And I don't want to say it's narrow, but I also understand the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a very big tent. So it goes both ways. But the Catholic part of me goes through the looking through the ballot, and it wasn't difficult at all that if I had to choose four other artists besides Willie, and of course Willie's at the top of the list, no brainer. You know, White Stripes, Rage Against the Machine, Warren Zevon, Iron Maiden, bang. So it's like not that expansive. Mm-hmm.
A pretty guitar forward
Rockist, you might even call
it. Yeah, rockist, some might call it. Yeah.
Look, I'm part of a weekly Zoom group, and it includes a high official with South by Southwest, another music critic, a working music DJ on the radio. And we all kind of kicked this around when it came up. You know, Willie, you know, you think he deserves to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? And, you know, there was some back and forth, you know, is he rock enough and all this, but it really boiled down to the easy way to go say, yeah, Willie, is Dolly Parton's in. It's like, I love Dolly Parton. I consider her music to be pop music, not rock and roll. And in that respect, that's a no-brainer because Willie has so much of a rock and roll element over the course of his career that has reared its head consistently through his career. So yeah, if Dolly's in, my argument would be that why wasn't Willie in 10 years ago? Mm-hmm. But that's kind of my thinking, that to be inclusive in bringing in country music, Willie is the icon. He's not just the icon of Texas music. He's the icon of American music. And when he passes, and this is where you got to get serious about it, when he passes, and I hope I've passed already because I couldn't stand to see that day. He's got over 800 tracks in the can. Mm-hmm. I mean, he told me this. He had 600-700 in the can 15 years ago. So you're going to be hearing new Willie Nelson into the 22nd season.
Right.
And not even Elvis can make that claim. And I don't think Elvis became Elvis completely until after Elvis had passed. And I don't think a lot of people that take Willie for granted now, or, you know, he's... if you're going to get high, there's no better guy to smoke, guy or man or woman to smoke weed with than Willie, because he's the gold standard. There's all kinds of Willies, you know, the friend of the family farmer, independent cat. But above all, he's this music maker that his body of work, no one comes close. So yeah, put him in.
We are definitely, that's going to be the majority of this episode, that we are definitely going to talk about all that. I am very, what do you talk about on this Zoom that you hang out with all these, you know, industry insiders, all these mucky mucks in the music biz?
We don't talk music that much. We talk about, you know, what's going on in Austin. No, I mean, we'll talk about if we've seen bands that we really like or who we don't like. There was a lot of talk, a couple of weeks ago when Lawrence Wright, Larry Wright, who's probably the best writer in Austin, had a piece in the New Yorker, which was kind of his meditation on what's become of Austin in the 50 years he's been here. Mm-hmm. I wrote a book 3 years ago called Austin to ATX that kind of covered that same subject. And, you know, it's this musing of going from little cool creative community to this, you know, this international destination for people. And, you know, all of the people that we talk that are in my group are old enough that we've seen this evolution. And there's, you know, that's always accompanied with a lot of complaints, oh, what we've lost and all that. But it's also, you know, what have you heard new? Who do you like? And we have been arguing the radio DJ and I are on opposite sides of the coin about Charlie Crockett. I think Charlie Crockett's kind of a continuum of this whole, what Willie started in, people like Jerry Jeff Walker, Ray Wiley Hubbard, Michael Martin Murphy, all these people in the early 70s, Willis Allen Ramsey, all these cats with three names. But what started with what was called progressive country, or this blend of traditional country with rock and roll and folk elements, that's, you know, whatever it is today, whatever Austin music means, it's the home of Austin City Limits, the longest running television series in music. All that stemmed from what was happening in the early 70s. So it's been kind of, it's been a wild ride to see it grow and become much bigger than what the little town it once was. And sometimes, you know, you shake your head about some of these knuckleheads that come into town and think they own it. It's still, you know, wherever you go, you come back and you realize there's still this unique, there's a groove to it that doesn't exist elsewhere.
Meanwhile, I'm over here like Charlie Crockett, putting it into my Google. And according to the genres on the main page, when he comes up, it says genres, blues, country, and then Americana, which I think is kind of like what that kind of hybrid of, you know, folk and country and rock and roll kind of has come to be under that umbrella of, like, Americana kind of vibe.
Americana started in Austin in 1972. And I'd argue it was really when Jerry Wexler signed Willie Nelson and Doug Somm to Atlantic Nashville, which was the new specialty label that the Erdogan brothers had given to Wexler. And what does he do? He goes and signs a 40-year-old has-been from Nashville that RCA couldn't get across. Chet Atkins couldn't get across. That's Willie. And Doug Somm had come back from San Francisco and was an obscure guy. And, you know, Nashville wasn't hearing any of this. The label didn't last long before the Erdogan pulled the plug. But artistically, that was what, you know, Jerry Wexler had a big role. He wanted to get into country, but he also showed people that were country-leaning, here's your possibilities.
Well, and so, fellow Hall of Famer Jerry Wexler also.
We're talking a lot of names.
You're dropping a lot of names that are, now the path is becoming clearer as far as how did we get here, not just Dolly with regard to, like, how did we get here to Willie on the ballot? Because I think Dolly is kind of the obvious, like, she opened the door and
sets
now
a precedent.
Yeah. But I guess thinking back to kind of, you know, all of the behind the scenes people who have also been inducted and are so heavily known and involved with the Hall, the dominoes are starting to line up for me.
There really was a connectivity. And, you know, the story behind that is it was not a successful venture. And for Doug Somm, I don't think he ever kind of got back to what he was, you know, what he was getting with Atlantic. And wherever his arc was, he ended up having a very rich career for 30 some odd years. But what it did was with Willie is when Jerry took him to Atlantic Studios in New York, where all these people, you know, famous people, Aretha's recorded there, everybody's recorded there. Willie was still in this country frame of mind where he's like, if you were working on the National Assembly line for RCA, you worked in 3-hour spurts and you got it all done quick. So Willie set a record that in 1 week at Atlantic Records, he recorded not one, but two albums. And then and it had horns and it had some funk in it. It was not a country album. And then within that year, all of a sudden Willie's live band expands and he's carrying two drummers and two bass players. I mean, this is like, you know, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but when I first saw him, which was right around this time, I'd known about him growing up in Fort Worth. I grew up in Fort Worth. And all throughout the 1960s, there was an independent television station called Channel 11, KTVT. And on Saturday night, they would play all the syndicated country music shows leading up to wrestling and roller derby at midnight. And it would start with the Cowtown Jamboree, which was a music show. Basically,
which sounds made up. That sounds made up. That sounds like a thing that someone says.
If you try to come up with a Southern,
TV.
Yeah.
No, but so he plays they have the Countdown Jamboree, and it's basically a 30-minute show to hype the acts that are going to be at Panther Hall, the country music ballroom, that night. And Willie was always on TV. He was there so much, you thought he lived in Fort Worth. Not that he was living in Nashville and driving down to Texas every weekend, because Texas was, it's where he could work and play and make money. And he came to Nashville as a songwriter, an extremely successful songwriter. And, but almost immediately, you know, Ray Price, Farron Young, for whom Willie wrote hit songs for, hey man, don't go out on the road. Willie was playing with Ray Price's Cherokee Cowboys, part of the band at first. And Farron Young both said, you know, stay in Nashville and write songs for you. We'll all get rich. And they didn't understand Willie, it wasn't enough Willie writing songs for them. He wanted to be them. So his period in Nashville from 1960 to 1972 was about a very successful songwriter who kept trying to get himself across as a recording artist.
That's another Dolly Parton parallel as well.
And early on, the only place he could do that was Texas. And he played so much. I mean, he did that 18-hour drive all every week. So I saw him on TV, but he was just a smiling country music guy. Now, in 1965, he did a live album at Panther Hall, which was this, it was the best country joint in Dallas or Fort Worth at the time. And he did an album called, it was called Live Country Music. And it was live at Panther Hall. And it's very telling that he does it with two players behind him. He plays guitar. He had a fiddler, Wade Ray, and he had a drummer, Johnny Bush. And that's it, a three-piece. And this live recording is still, I mean, it's much treasured and talked about. But it's very interesting because in his set, he does a lot of his songs. He does his medleys of the songs he's famous for, his country songs. But he does some new originals. And then he does Yesterday by the Beatles. And there's not many country people, period, in 1965 that are acknowledging this new act coming out of England, the Beatles. Willie's on to him. It's not in his sound so much, but the fact he covered the Beatles showed me then you can see he's got an open mind and he's really kind of looking for a sound. Okay, fast forward from 1965. I saw him in 1973 in Austin. That was the first time. He had finally moved to Austin that year and settled down for good. Actually, in 1972, I moved to Austin in 1973 in August. In October, the local Ford dealership, Mac Morris Ford, had to show off their new 1974 Fords. And so they advertised Willie Nelson country music, free hot dogs, and free Cokes.
Perfect.
And they cleared out the body shop.
There you go.
Cleared out the body
the
shop.
Trifecta.
Big old dealership. And there was a band playing on the flatbed trailer. You know, this was like classic car dealer country music function in Texas. Free hot dogs, by the way, too. And, you know, you sat around and you watched this band cranking. And he was at the point, he hadn't expanded to two drummers yet or two bass players. That would happen within the year. But it was just a kind of a typical country music set, running through his hits, Funny How Time Slips Away, Crazy, all the songs that he was known for. But in the middle of a song called Bloody Mary Morning, which he had already recorded a couple times in Nashville, and then he recorded it once for Jerry Wexler on this new album that was just coming out. In the middle of Bloody Mary Morning, the band takes off and they go into a jam. And listen, I had seen the year before, I saw the Allman Brothers with Dwayne and Dickey play 2 weeks before Dwayne died. I saw them in Dallas.
Wow.
And I'd seen the Grateful Dead a couple years earlier. And what I was seeing on this in this car lot, and the body in the garage of this car lot on a flatbed trailer, I was hearing a jam band again. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't heard a jam like that since the Allmans or the Grateful Dead. Now are we talking, can we talk about what's rock and roll and what's country?
See,
music?
Now you're getting me. I knew this was going to happen. I mean, I was prepared to be swayed by feeling like Willie is more, I've been prepared. I've been ready. I've had my mind, you know, open. I wouldn't say the door is wide open for me to be like, yeah, you know what? Let's go, Willie. For me, my whole reticence about Willie with the Hall is like, this was the fear that we had when Dolly got inducted, was that suddenly we now have to induct all the country greats. And there's a backlog of other genres of music that don't have their own Hall of Fame that have yet to be inducted. Like this, that's my biggest kind of qualm with this induction is like, Willie Nelson, obviously a legend, obviously an icon. Words that I've used to describe Dolly Parton, who I love very much and was very happy that she is included in the Hall. But I was like, oh no, I don't necessarily want this to become now. We have to get all the greats in from country because we've gotten some of them in already. Yes, I understand, but
we haven't got Waylon and Merle in. And
right.
Okay, so here's my argument though.
Sure.
What I've seen in the country in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in this effort to be more inclusive, done a very good job in working, you know, rhythm and blues, soul, even disco and funk. But I think, you know, that's great. That's if you're looking at the macro issue, what is rock and roll? That's part of it. But you left out the country part. And to me, that's rock and roll came out of, you know, whether you want to argue equal parts, whatever, rhythm and blues and country and Western,
mm-hmm.
colliding and merging. That's rock and roll because rockabilly, all that stuff, that leaned more country than rhythm and blues.
Mm-hmm.
So it to me, it's kind of a natural progression to, if you're going to include rhythm and blues, if you're going to include the Spinners, you damn well better include Willie Nelson.
And yet they don't include the Spinners yet. Yeah, and it's doubtful they will.
But yeah, I mean, the complicated issues are, you know, it seems as though the Rock Hall defined itself for decades with a relatively solid line dividing the two. Because like, why would Willie only be considered, because he's never been on a ballot, why would he only be considered now? It seems as though, especially since the Country Music Hall of Fame had been well established, I think it's early 60s, I think possibly the Country Music Hall of Fame started before the Beatles even released a record.
Yep.
So that history and lineage is so defined before even what you could call the heyday of rock and roll, it felt very separate. And that just seemed to be based on who's being inducted into the Rock Hall, how they're operating. And you can say like, oh yes, now that it's more inclusive. What Kristen was saying is, you know, there's so many, you know, the biggest argument about the Hall's mismanagement is the huge backlog of very worthy artists who are not in, still waiting to get in. And what's a little bit frustrating about including country is that you almost double the list. Like if you're saying, okay, country now is involved, belongs, suddenly this backlog of artists you have to get in gets so much wider because like you said, starting with relatively foundational like Waylon and Merle, and then just you think about all the artists who are eligible beyond them, it just becomes a little bit overwhelming.
There's probably a list of what I would like. My guy Doug Sum, I was asking in 2016, what's it going to take to get him in the Hall, and it was kind of explained the balloting system and all that, and I thought, well, you know, he's not going to get elected in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but I got him in the Hall with this movie. I got to screen it there and everybody loved it. It was a great house, got great stories from people that showed up. It was a great cathartic experience for me, just liking the guy. And there'd be kind of a campaign, get Doug in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That ain't going to happen. And so,
been nominated. Sir Douglas Quintet has been on the ballot before once.
Wait, for real?
In 2006. And I think our friend Greg Geller is the one who nominated him.
I would not be surprised that mm-hmm. Greg Geller, because he's a big champion. But, you know, it's the same thing. I was at the Country Music Hall of Fame. There's a guy a real heavyweight in the history of country music, a guy named H.W. Pappy Daly. And he had a record empire in Houston. He broke people like George Jones, another person who should be in the Rock Hall. But he got all these people in, and his grandson plays with George Strait. And he kind of complained to me. He said, you know, he's never been recognized by the Country Music Hall of Fame. Pappy Daly's not in the Country Music Hall of Fame. And I went and started asking people there, and there's like a legacy track, but it is so stacked up with other people that also deserve to be in there. I can't mm-hmm. wait saying Happy Nightly's not going to be in the Country Music Hall of Fame. That's just the way that the system's going and how you keep expanding it. He's just kind of at the back of the line, and time's not, you know, he's dead. Time's not on his side.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important for an institution like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame to be sensitive to what's going on in the here and now and how it reflects into the past. So I got, you know, I think it's completely natural. And some people may have blanched way back when James Brown gets in. But, you know, mm-hmm. that's no question in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, when I think of James Brown in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, my logic from what I've been raised on, you know, Willie is as natural as James Brown, even though they're two different musical artists, very different. Musical
very, yeah, artists. Different genre, ends of the genre.
Yeah. And you know what's kind of interesting is there's a little bit of a reflection happening at the Country Music Hall of Fame. Just when I think about last year, Ray Charles was finally inducted. This year, Jerry Lee Lewis, like two artists who were in the first year of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, are now, you know, finally getting into the Country Music Hall of Fame. There's some parallels going on. I see where the net is being widened in both institutions.
It blows my mind that it took this long for Jerry Lee.
Yeah, right.
And, now, Ray mm-hmm. Charles, you know, the modern sounds of country and Western music, that album, that was one that I picked up on when Willie hit the road with Ray Price and his Cherokee Cowboys, 1960 or 61. He's writing songs, making money, but he wanted to play and he wanted to perform and he wanted to be Ray Price. The band was all listening. That was one of their favorite albums that they listened to. They were listening to jazz, but they were listening to Ray Charles, and especially when he crossed over and singing country. We hear country and we look at these guys dressed in nudie suits and think they're country, but they were hip cats. They were jazz players wearing boots, cowboy boots. And mm-hmm. and they thought of themselves as, you know, they were improvisationalists. They could play it tight when you had to play the hit song. But when they were given time to stretch, Ernest Tubb's Texas Troubadours, I mean, Ernest Tubb, everybody thinks that's, you can't get any more country than that. Ernest Tubb's Texas Troubadours, you got to listen to hear them play Red Top, which Ray Benson of Asleep at the Wheel told me when the band first started, they sought out the Troubadours because they were jazz players. But people didn't look at them as jazz players. They thought they were hillbillies.
Well, I got to ask you, I want to make sure we get to this.
Okay.
You wrote a book about Willie Nelson.
Yeah, 500-page biography.
I want to know what led you to the decision to write about Willie.
Yeah, I moved to Austin in 1973. I'd been running a record store in Minneapolis called The Electric Fetus. Still there, but I got homesick. And I wanted to write. And I'd sent in a blind review of this guy, Doug Somm, a kind of an outtake album that Mercury put out when Atlantic put out the album with Bob Dylan on it and Dr. John. And I wrote about the album that, no, you know, the cheap throwaway that Mercury put out. And I sent in a review to Cream Magazine, and I got a letter back from Lester Bangs along with a $30 check saying, wow, you write really good. You know, you ought to do more stuff for us. And I was kind of empowered. I'd been trying to did a little bit of reviewing. So I'm moving back to Texas, and I'm going to write about music in Texas. I'm not going to move to New York. Not interested in L.A. Nashville, forget it. That's it creeped me out. I was going to move back to Texas, and there's this new scene coming up. But it wasn't in Fort Worth where I grew up. It was in Austin. And I'd been reading Chet Flippo and Rolling Stone and Cream, who had been filing reports from Austin. And something was happening. So I wanted to move to Austin. And I did. And within the first or second month, not only did I see Willie play at the car lot, I interviewed Willie for a third-rate music magazine. I shouldn't say third-rate because there's people still alive. A magazine called Zoo World, uh-huh, which was, I got my foot in the door with the Zoo World magazine. And I interviewed Willie at Coke FM, which was the world's only progressive country radio station at the time.
Oh.
Where you could hear the Rolling Stones and Ernest Tubb back to back.
Wow.
And then where Willie Nelson would come in with Christofferson and do an impromptu concert just because they wanted to play. It was that kind of a deal. So I interviewed mm-hmm. Willie, and I remember watching him before I interviewed him at Coke. He was being interviewed in a boardroom by Chet Flippo. And I knew who Ted Flippo was, and it was kind of like, you know, this is the kind of the guy I want to be. And I was watching Willie, and it was like such a trip because he had a headband on. His hair was kind of getting a little bit long. He dressed like all of us did. He had a t-shirt and cutoffs and running shoes. And kind of the only giveaway was he had a little diamond horseshoe pinky ring. He had a stud in his earring, and no country guys were wearing studs in his earring. I look back and I realize I was probably asking really stupid questions, but he was very kind and open and answered everything that I asked. And from then on, whether it was Rolling Stone, I became a staff writer at Texas Monthly Magazine. I would visit Willie at least once or twice a year. Early on, up until 75, I was reporting on him pretty steadily because this thing phenomenally started. The picnics every 4th of July became a deal. They were our Woodstock in Texas, Willie Nelson picnics. And again, Willie would invite his friends like Waylon, Billy Joe Shaver, Kris Kristofferson. But his friends pretty quickly expanded to people like Leon Russell. He met Leon in Austin in 1973. And that's when Leon Russell is the master of space and time. He's set up shop in Tulsa with his own recording complex. He's got Shelter Records. He's got a bunch of people recording for him. He's into this new thing called video. So he's got Shelter Vision. And when Willie met him, and this is just when Leon is fixing to do his retro album, Hank Wilson's Back, in which this rock and roller goes and does country because he's a Tulsa guy. He knows all these styles. So Leon's fixing to do Hank Wilson's Back. And Willie is like in between his Atlantic albums. And when he meets Leon Russell, it's pretty clear. Willie wants to be Leon. You know, you've got a whole empire here, right? In Tulsa, of all places. I can do the same here in Austin. And Leon wants to be Willie because Willie is that authentic country cat that Leon is aspiring to be on Hank Wilson's Back. Mm. So it begins this friendship and relationship that, you know, by 1980, they're making albums together. They tour together. Is that not rock and roll? Part of this argument, when I saw Willie nominated, I do a radio show that's broadcast out of Marfa and Wimberley. It's called the Texas Music Hour Power. And I play all kinds of Texas music, going back to the beginning of recorded music to the here and now. And the other day I played Good Hearted Woman, which was a song that Willie and Waylon Jennings made famous and was a hit. And it crossed over into onto the pop charts from country. But I played the version that Willie and Leon recorded at the Capitol Theater for WNEW, which was an album rock station in New York in 1980. And I played it. She's a good-hearted woman in love with a good-time man. You tell me that's not rock and roll. We got some headbutting to do. Because it's knocked out. It's frenzied. They do a lot of improvisation. They're harmonizing together. And that relationship was one of those things that to me really solidified, if you want to look at Willie as this multi-musical guy beyond country music, his relationship with Leon really set that tone. Mm-hmm. And it continued on. And like in the 1990s, does tours with the Grateful Dead, Willie Nelson and the Grateful Dead together. And they jam, the different musicians for both bands jam together. He does the Ballpark tour with Bob Dylan. And, you know, it's Willie Nelson and Bob Dylan. That's it. And they're buddies, guilt by association.
No, I mean, totally. I mean, genre distinctions aside, though, you know, one of the other frustrating things about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is they do not really publish a list of criteria that makes an artist eligible or a worthy inductee into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Every voter kind of has to come up with their own categories. And
every voter, every podcaster.
I think that's to everyone's benefit.
What I've done is I've actually come up with a list of my own categories that I think if an artist does well in those categories, it builds a good case for induction. So what I want to do is I want to take a quick break. And then when we come back, let's evaluate Willie Nelson via those categories. So we'll be right back.
The Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. We hope you had a nice break. We hope over your break, you said something nice.
Yep.
To yourself, to someone else, doesn't matter. All right. So Willie Nelson became eligible for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as early as the hall existed. So, you know, the 1986 ceremony, he released his first single in 1957, which easily puts him as eligible for that first class. And that single was No Place for Me, which is a 78 second song.
It's so old, another love grown cold. I can see this is no place for me.
Willie has never been on a ballot before. This is his first appearance in 2023. Although he does have a history with the Hall of Fame, he inducted the Allman Brothers Band in 1995. And I think even more interestingly than that, at the end of that evening, he performed at the ceremony with another inductee in 1995, Al Green. And they did Funny How Time Slips Away, which... is a song Willie wrote, and many people covered it, but I think Al Green was the one who had the biggest hit with it, and they do a duet on it, and it's great. You can watch it on YouTube. It's amazing.
And it's funny how time slips away. Hey, yeah. And it's funny.
One of Willie's many duets.
Yes, yeah, so with the king of the duet, Willie
the
Nelson.
King of the duet.
Well, that was a weird thing, because Funny How Time Slips Away was one of his the triad that got him over in Nashville, Hello Walls and Crazy. Those were songs that all became hits. And Funny was recorded traditionally, but it also crossed over to pop. But it kind of sold as R&B. And Joe Hinton, who had recorded for the Duke Peacock Empire out of Houston, did a version that was very popular in the early 60s. This was before Al Green, but this is where you really get into it, that Al Green knows a soulful song. Willie sings, he writes, many of tunes are what I would consider to be white man blues. He just happens to be white, but he's singing blues. And in fact, before he got to Nashville, the year before, in 1959, and then into 60, he was in Houston trying to make it. And it's before he went to Nashville. And he was recording for Pappy Daly on D Records. He was a recording artist. D was a regional country label that had a lot of artists. But he recorded this song, Nightlife. And it was so soulful and bluesy. Pappy Daly would not release the record. It sounded too black. Wow. And he wasn't going to put a record out like that. So instead, that record finally came out under the title of Paul Buskirk and His Merry Men, featuring Hugh Nelson.
The nightlife ain't a good life, but it's my life.
Paul Buskirk was led the backing band on this recording session. It's got xylophones on it. It's got Herb Remington, the great steel player that Freddie King covered. It's a great song, but Dee wouldn't put it out, so Willie put it out on his own. So when he got to Nashville and he's playing his songs at Tootsie's for other songwriters and kind of getting discovered, they know about Nightlife. And they also know that he wrote the song Family Bible, which he sold to Claude Gray for $50 because he needed
There's
the money.
A Family Bible on the table.
Claude Gray had the hit, and it didn't have Willie's name on it, but people in the business knew about it. So he always had you know, he always had soul, a soulful edge. He talks about, or talked to me about, picking cotton as a kid, which this is a great experience of a lot of American musicians of his period of time. And when he picked cotton, he heard black music and he heard Mexican music being sung, because that's what the workers sang. And there were a lot of blacks and Mexicans in the field. But at the same time, when he was like 8 years old, he liked to play guitar. And his parents, grandparents were singing school teachers. They raised Willie and his sister on music and how to play music. And so he joined his neighbor's band. John Rachek was a man who led a polka band, a Czech polka band. And it was like 15 pieces and it was all brass, but they let their neighbor little Willie come and play with them once. And he got paid $8 for the gig. And he saw that $8 and it's like, that's what he'd make in a full day of picking cotton. Mm-hmm. And that's the last time he picked cotton.
Know,
he did the math real quick. He's going to be a music guy.
I'm sure.
So, but he absorbed all these different sounds, even though you're raised, certainly during that period of time in rural Texas, you're an Anglo person, you're probably going to steer country and not to blues or rock and roll. Rock and roll was too new back then when he's growing up.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. So we were already talking a little bit about some of these songs, some that he written, some that he's recorded. The first category here is iconic / recognizable songs. And from a country perspective, we could spend hours on this. But I think both for the purposes of time and the purposes mm-hmm. of our discussion with the Rock Hall, I want to talk about what songs do we think people who aren't necessarily country fans would know. And we can also look at this from the perspective of a rock and roll magazine, Rolling Stone, which puts out occasionally different lists of the 500 greatest songs total. And I guess my question I pose to you guys is, do you think Rolling Stone put any Willie songs?
Oh my gosh, we're back to this. Wow. Okay.
We haven't done this. Yeah, we
haven't done this in a long time.
A year. Do you think any Willie songs are iconic enough to make the Rolling Stone list of the 500 greatest songs?
Ooh. Oh, sure. I'd probably say Crazy is what jumps to mind, because that made Patsy Cline's career.
Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling so lonely.
It really became an anthem, I think, in the late 20th century. It was a standard in every lesbian bar in the United States. That was on the jukebox. For some reason, it was the way Patsy sung it, but that song was just like, it resonated outside of what you would consider its traditional realm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, that's correct. We got one on the board. Crazy has been on every iteration of this list. The most recent one, it was at 195.
And it's currently being sung at karaoke somewhere in the world. Every 10 minutes,
cosmically.
You can guarantee cosmically Crazy is being sung at a karaoke bar somewhere on this planet. Yeah.
So that has a lot of resonance. The thing is, when he became popular as Willie, the guy we know today, you know, Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain broke him, and that was an old country standard. He didn't write it.
In twilight glow, I see blue eyes crying in the rain.
And Blue Skies, when he did Stardust, which, talk about, you know, he always went against the grain. Columbia didn't want to put out Red-Headed Stranger, the song cycle album that included Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain, that really broke Willie nationally. They didn't want to put it out. They thought it was a good demo. But mm-hmm. Willie's manager had negotiated for artistic control. And so Columbia put it out against everybody's, you know, all the internal brass. Billy Sherrill wanted to take it to Nashville and make it, give it more of that Nashville sound. They put it out and it was, you know, a million seller. And what does he do? He follows that up with Stardust, which is Willie Nelson and Booker T. Jones, Booker T. and the MGs getting together and picking out their favorite songs they grew up with from the American Songbook, and puts that out. So
he defies expectation. He goes against what a country artist is supposed to do. And I'd say that's pretty rock and roll. From an attitude perspective.
Definitely when he's blowing up and Nashville didn't like it. And the response was, RCA getting together some of these old tracks, and they still had Waylon Jennings, and they put out Wanted the Outlaws. Now, you got to understand, that's a Nashville sell. It's a hype. No one was talking outlaw music. There in Texas, it was Cosmic Cowboys. Outlaws, come on, what is this? But that was a Nashville confection, but that's what it took. So Good Hearted Woman, which came out of that, would be maybe another standard that has some resonance.
So you mentioned Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain, which is on there. That's been on every iteration of the list. Most recently, it was at 253. So that's a second one. There's only one other one. And I would say, in my opinion, as a person who did not really grow up with country, doesn't know country as a genre very well, there is one Willie Nelson song that I definitely knew and could sing the melody to.
Would you say it's On the Road Again?
It's On the Road Again.
Okay.
Yeah.
Road again, going places that I've never been, seeing things that I may never see again. I can't wait to get on the road again.
For me, as a non-country person, On the Road Again and You Were Always on My Mind are like probably the two songs that I associate most with Willie Nelson.
You Were Always on My Mind. Willie appropriated that. He stole it. It's his song, not Elvis's anymore.
Right? No, it's his biggest pop hit.
You were always on my mind. You were always on my mind.
That's Willie's song. He owns it. By the way, he sings it.
By the way, he sings it. Yeah.
On the Road Again, you're absolutely right. I mean, there's a lot of Willie music. That was done for the movie Honeysuckle Rose, which Willie appears in and inspired Slim Pickens to say, no one plays Willie Nelson any better than Willie Nelson does. It's kind of his left-handed compliment. But so Sidney Pollack needed a song for the album, for the soundtrack. And Willie, can you write something, something about being on the road? And so Willie just said, you mean like On the Road Again? Can't wait to get on the road again. And basically in his head, wrote a song in a New York minute. Uh-huh. And it is, to me, this anthem of American mobility. That it's just, and it's an American song.
Absolutely.
It's the idea of just, we've got these highways that we travel, and that's where we dream and we explore. And as far as a music person who travels from town to town, I can't wait to get on the road again. Willie loves the road, and which is at this stage in his life, as he turns 90, he can't go do one nighters on the bus like he used to, but he loves the idea of the road and what it represents. And Lord almighty, in the 60s, in the 70s and 80s for sure, the amount of miles that he put on the road are phenomenal, all the way into really the late 1990s. And in the mid 90s, he kind of changed the sound of the band. So he went, and they were kind of toned down. Up till then, to see a Willie Nelson between 1972 and 1995, if you saw a Willie Nelson show, you're going to have two drummers. And you're not going to, Willie's going to play as long as he wants. That was what was really cool in the mid-70s is he's blowing up. They don't even know about him in Louisiana yet. And, Redheaded Stranger hadn't come out yet. But you'd see shows that he'd play, Austin, Dallas, Houston, wherever. And, you go to a show and good luck. He's going to outplay you. He would go for 4 or 5 hours and just play as long as they want. And that was kind of that Grateful Dead attitude. It was like, we're having fun, we're playing music, and let's go for it. Mm-hmm. And don't get in the way. And it was all of a sudden, instead of you go to a backstage, see anyone else, and there's probably 20 people gathered backstage. A Willie Nelson backstage was all of a sudden 200 or 300 people. In all walks of life, from a state politico to a well-known drug dealer, everybody's back.
Everybody's there.
Which is another thing that I know I keep talking about kind of the Dolly Parton things, but like she's a very unifying force. Mm-hmm. It's like you have red states and blue states. Everybody adores her. She's like a unifying connector, and I think of him as a similar type of icon with regard to you have like diehard country music fans, you've got potheads, you've got like he brings together like a wide swath of types of people, mm-hmm. Which is I think firmly a point in his column.
In 1972, He's moved to Austin. And he's played a couple gigs around town. He notices the hippies. He's letting his hair grow long. His daughter, Lana, had gone to the Atlanta International Pop Festival and came back to Nashville and said, "Dad, I think there's a better place for you." And he found it in Austin. But it opened his mind to the possibilities. And so he was taking risks that other people weren't taking. And it's interesting that, you know, when you mentioned Dolly, I think 75 or so is when she conscientiously relocated from Nashville to LA. Mm-hmm. You know, here I come again.
Right.
Came out and kind of broke her, but she did it at the expense of leaving Nashville behind. And she was pretty established in Nashville. She was making hits. Mm-hmm. Willie had tried to make hits in Nashville, but never broke through. So people in the community knew him. And, you know, they all knew one another, but he just wasn't able to break through. So he danced around country. And then basically, you know, when you're 40 in country music, 40 years old, you're supposed to retire and sell insurance or just go spend all your time at the country club. That's it. You're done. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And here, this guy at 40 years old comes back to his home ground. And
he says, "I'm not even halfway done. I'm going to be doing this when I'm 90.
Yeah, right. Just getting started.
It barely started, but I think it was that rock and roll attitude, which was rife in Austin because no one's painting within the lines. Everybody's trying to paint outside the lines musically. Yeah. So if you're rock and roll, you're probably adding a lot of country or folk or rhythm and blues. I mean, that's all these things were mixing it up and nothing was really dominant. I would say, so in 1972, Willie sees this in Austin and he shows up, they're staying out in a defunct dude ranch in Bandera. The band found sacred ground after Willie's house burned down in Nashville. And his booking agent found him at this place in a dude ranch. And every Saturday they're playing a place called Flora's General Store in Helotes, and the sign's still there. Willie Nelson's Saturday Night, the sign's still there today. But they were going to go to Austin to visit Willie's sister, Bobby, who's a piano player, and she was working piano bars in Austin. And they picked up a hippie chick in their Winnebago. That's how they travel, was this old Winnebago. And shortly after, outside of Bandera, they're on their way to Austin. They pick up a hippie chick. "Where are you going?" "I'm going to Austin too." And she had them let her out at this place called the Armadillo World Headquarters, which was a hippie concert hall. And it was run by hippies. There was no business plan. This was a collective. And Willie took note. And a few weeks later, he showed up in the beer garden at the Armadillo with Paul English, his drummer, and his back, the guy that looks like the devil, very intimidating cat. And they found Eddie Wilson, the head honcho at the Armadillo, and the booking agent, Bobby Hederman, and said, "We want to play here." And Eddie had been, he had run some weed up to San Francisco the year before, and someone turned him on to Willie's album, Yesterday's Wine, which was very country, but it was a concept album about mortality and being on earth, very heavy. And so when Willie said, "We've been wanting to play here," Willie said, "I've been waiting for you. I've been wanting you to play here." So Willie and B. Spears and Paul English, it was a three piece again, B. Spears on bass and Paul English on drums, play the Armadillo. And the Armadillo is for hippies. There were a few of old Willie Nelson fans that showed up in their beehive hairdos and their leisure. But it was mainly
the culture
hippies.
Clash. Yeah.
And know it, but that's what it is. The lions lay down with the lambs because they had this common bond. They all loved Willie Nelson and what he was doing. And they all kind of settled down, you know, beer is good, pot's good. It was kind of this
hell yeah.
So, beer drinking it was cool among hippies. Around in San Francisco, you know, they didn't talk about, you know, drinking beer was all psychedelics. But in Austin, Willie playing the Armadillo was this great fusion. That was the moment when everything came together. And within months, Waylon Jennings is playing the Armadillo. Tom T. Hall is playing the Armadillo. And they're finding these audiences that they didn't know existed. And they were huge and they were rabid audiences. They yelled and they whooped and it was like, it was a rock and roll crowd. But they were hooping and hollering over this music that some people would have typecast as country. But certainly at this time, Waylon and Willie's bands live, they were rock bands. Mm-hmm. They were rock and roll bands. Yeah, Waylon is, you know, he was mentored by Buddy Holly. I think you've heard of him.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there's kind of that, I don't know if it's a fully true story about flipping a coin. Waylon was going to be on the aircraft that then went down, and we lost Buddy Holly in that. But on the topic of kind of crossing over and mm-hmm. not being defined by the country lines that were drawn, I just want to quickly, since we're still, I want to close out this category of songs with the two biggest crossover hits of Willie's career. We talked about Always On My Mind, which is 1982, went to number five on the Hot 100 and was a cover. You know, Brenda Lee first recorded it. But oddly enough, what I thought was interesting was when Willie did it, it was a crossover to the pop charts, one song of the year at the Grammys. But when Elvis did it,
you were always on.
It was a hit on the country charts. And so it was a complete reversal of what you would expect. And then the second crossover hit that also went to number five on the pop charts is his duet with Julio Iglesias, To All the Girls I've Loved Before.
Okay.
We dedicate the song to all the girls we love.
So outside of the kind of country realm, those might be songs you would know because at the time they played on the radio.
So this was like, by this time, by 1980, Willie had bought this old country club west of town. I call it Willie World. It's Lubbock, Texas, which has its own Western movie set because he filmed movies there, and his own studio, Pernella Sound, that Chips Moman designed. And all of a sudden, because Willie's Willie, he's recording with everybody and anybody. So all the old timers that he used to work with, Farron Young comes in, Ray Price comes in, they all duet, but it's like, Willie's like, who do you got? I could do anything.
Yeah. Right.
And I think Connie Nelson, his previous wife, and Willie were in London, and she went to the Virgin Records store and was listening to stuff and heard Julio Iglesias and went back to Willie and said, you know, this guy's pretty interesting. So they had not met before. They didn't know each other. But Willie, hey, you know, come do this song. And I think it kind of flipped Julio out. You know, he came in with a limousine and bodyguards and all this stuff out to Pernellas. And there's Willie and all these people sitting around smoking pot, dressed in cutoffs. And there's this guy right behind Willie that's always kind of looking there. That happens to be Darryl K. Royal, the former coach of the University of Texas Longhorns.
Okay.
Team, who is like, talk about Texas icons. Well, after he coached, hang out with Willie all the time. And he was all, they would play golf. And then when they go record, Coach Roy was always right behind Willie watching him and paying attention and offering advice. Julio was probably going, who are these people and what's going on?
Yeah, I bet. Yeah.
Yeah.
But look, this is about the same time Rick James is hanging out at Willie World. They're everybody
you could think of, yeah.
Anybody is beginning to make pilgrimages, and Willie is welcome all comers. And the beauty of the Julio project is they brought their two radically different fan bases together. Julio at the time, definitely the number one male vocalist in the Latin world, period. Mm-hmm. And Willie's, you know, next to God with after all these albums, and, you know, Stardust is setting records as the longest running country music album ever on the charts. So, you know, it was kind of so unnatural, it was a natural fit.
Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned albums. I want to make sure we go to clip here and we get all these categories in. The next category is classic albums. Does he have albums that are considered all-time classics? And again, you know, 73 studio albums solo. We could get stuck in this. So we can try to look at this again a rock perspective. We can look at, again, at that, because the Rolling Stone also had lists of the 500 greatest albums. Do we think any of those Willie albums popped up on the 500 greatest
albums.
Well,
it should. I mean, I'm not going to second guess Rolling Stone, and I, God forbid that I do here. But, I was part of a team a couple of years ago at Texas Monthly Magazine. I was one of five people that were part of a team that ranked all 141 albums that Willie Nelson had put out. 141.
Incredible. And, you know, yes, and I
at that point. Now, since then, there
yeah, well, there's been a few more. But, yeah. You know, there was kind of a general feeling it would be Redheaded Stranger as this album, or you can maybe make the argument for Stardust, but Redheaded Stranger, that was one where the worm turned, and it was a thematic album. But I fought, and I actually got to write about the number one album on Texas Monthly's list, and that was Phases and Stages, which was the second album Willie recorded for Atlantic Records and Jerry Wexler, and would have been, it was starting to go up the charts when the Erdogans pulled the plug on Jerry Wexler and the label folded. So it never really got its chance. But to me, that's kind of, it's a fully formed concept album. It's about a divorce, a man and a woman, and he writes it from both a male and female perspective, which is taken a big leap at that time, you think about it, and he does it convincingly. But Phases and Stages should be on that. And as far as I know, I mean, I already talked this through with Texas Monthly, and we did a lot of arguing in our rankings, but Phases and Stages wound up number one. Number two was Redheaded Stranger. So take your choice. I mean,
right.
I guess Rolling Stone said Redheaded Stranger.
And you're right. Yeah. So, I think you kind of explained why Phases and Stages, you know, makes a little bit more sense if you're really thinking about it. But this is a broad list, including albums of artists of all stripes. So Redheaded Stranger is on the list. It's at 237.
And Stardust is on the list.
And Stardust was on the original list. I think on the most recent list, it was not. But yeah, both those albums were on the original list. You know, Redheaded Stranger being the album that made him a star after over a decade of, you know, tepid success and being, you know, his most of his success coming as a songwriter. And then Stardust being the unexpected left turn. You shouldn't do this. He does it anyway. And it's a big success. This album of covers of pop standards.
And it never stopped selling.
Right. And that's his most successful. At this point, it's gone five times platinum. And that's the one that Booker T produced. But from your expert perspective, you would Phases and Stages, which didn't quite, it was like right before the big break, but was part of that run of establishing concept albums, which was foreign to the country world at that time, even though the rock world was Sergeant Peppering and doing all these concepts.
He did three concept albums. I mean, the first one was in 71, and that was Yesterday's Wine, and it was for RCA. And again, except for some Hep Cats in San Francisco, it flew over almost anyone's head. I was in Minneapolis then. And I started listening to it. I think it was because Chet Flippo reviewed it in Rolling Stone. And it was like, you know, played it over and over again. And it made me homesick. And it was like, it was a great concept album. But Yesterday's Wine was concept. Phases and Stages was concept. And Redheaded Stranger was concept. And that's pretty deep. I mean, and each one is kind of a different theme. But to string songs together that way, no one was doing that. I mean, he was recording albums, and people in Nashville were recording singles, and if they put out an album, sandwiching the A side and the B side with filler. That was the mentality.
Let's go to these. We would not have to spend a ton of time on these next categories because you can almost summarize them with a word or two. Critical acclaim, yes. Beloved, I mean, he, like you were just saying, especially the fact that once he started making these concept albums and showing some depth, I think that was very embraced by the critical community. Commercial success, you know, there's a few statistics. I saw something like 70 million records sold. You look at his albums, plenty of them have gone platinum, including some that have charted respectively on the pop charts. And a lot of them peak at number one on the country charts or towards the top. But then, you know, respectable numbers on the top 200 for Billboard. And then worth noting, Juan of the Outlaws with Waylon and Jesse Coulter was the first country album to go platinum. So he was setting records as a country artist in terms of commercial success.
Yeah. Music critics love him. Sit down with him. Wonderful person to talk to. Always open, you know, always answered pretty much all my questions that I ever had. And especially with the book, I was lucky that he said he would talk to me. It was unauthorized, but you never know, especially when you're doing it unauthorized. And I went and saw the band do 5 days at the Fillmore in San Francisco so I could interview all the band and crew that I had for this book I was working on. And I went to thank him the last night on the bus. And he said, when are we going to talk? And I wasn't sure we were going to talk. I said, whenever you want, right after the show. So I had to go. I missed the show. I had to go back and get my stuff, go to the airport, dump my rent car, come back. And I got on the bus just as the show was over. And before Willie had carpal tunnel in the early 2000s, he would stay to the last person to autograph. If someone was in line, he would stay for him. He wasn't doing that anymore when in 2007, when I saw him at the Fillmore. So I got on the bus and the bus started rolling. And after he and his sister ate breakfast that was cooked by Willie's oldest daughter, Lana, after they finished that, we sat down around 11 o'clock and went till 3 a.m.
Wow.
And I'm trying to remember everything I wanted to ask him. And he smoked me under the table finally. It was like, I said, no, Moss, I give up. And no, he said, we're in Santa Rosa, California. David Anderson's got your hotel room key here. Go there. I'm off tomorrow. So let's talk.
Wow.
And so I had a chance to go over my manuscript, everything that I'd had. And basically the next day, what I hadn't asked him the night before, he answered pretty much everything I asked. So that kind of openness, that's that person. You know, if he's guarded, it's the people around him that are guarded. That ain't Willie. Mm-hmm. And it's similarly, he did that with radio. In the 60s, he would always stop at the radio station. You remember the DJs. So when that Redheaded Stranger came out and Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain was released by Columbia as a single, there were a lot of disc jockeys that were more than ready to repay all the favors Willie had given them as far as being nice and open. Mm-hmm. And so that the relationships he's had with the press and with radio have been one reason why he is who he is today, and why today, after all these years, he remains very beloved by everybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, you know, people that don't like Willie Nelson don't know who he is.
So, I think that's probably true. Let's talk about the next category, longevity. Just kind of to recap what we've already established here. First single in 57, first album in 62, you know, doing reasonably well in the country charts for what feels like a decade, then becomes a huge success in 75 with Redheaded Stranger, and then maintains his relevance, starts to have a successful crossover period in the 80s with Always On My Mind and Julio Iglesias and We Are the World. And, you know, in 1985, he's considered big enough to have a verse with the biggest names at that time. God has shown us. And I would say it's really not until he keeps this up probably till the dawn of the 90s, which is when he kind of transitions into becoming a legacy act. But that's quite a run, maybe as long as a run as we've ever talked about anyone. You know, the idea that
he's a legacy act that is still putting out new music. Not like, you know, his relationship with producer Buddy Cannon kind of just defines his recordings in the 2000s. But they've got a pretty good system, and you know, he's putting out product left and right.
Prolific is an understatement. Let's talk about the next category, influence. And I want to try and, like, obviously there's a ton of influence in the country genre, but I want to see if we can pinpoint some rock and roll influence or pop or just kind of beyond the world of country.
Well, everybody, go look at that lineup for his 90th birthday at the Hollywood Bowl. And it's basically, you know, you're looking at a lineup of American music. You're not seeing just country acts. He transcended countries when he moved to Austin. And, you know, anything country after then was Nashville trying to grab on to what he's doing. He's off on his own. And as far as influence, you know, Margot, the current crop, people like Margot Price, she hung out with him for a while. Now she's launched her own career and has become very, very successful. There is just time and again, he's always taken young people in and let them work with him and play with him. And I use an example. I mentioned him earlier. This kind of the latest is this guy, Charlie Crockett, who mixes all these different sounds and is he's huge here right now in Texas. I don't know how he's doing in the rest of the country, but the influence, he introduced the Allman Brothers at the Rock Hall.
The Rock Hall. No, it's true. I mean, all you have to do, and we do not have the time to do it. Look at the artists who have covered Willie Nelson. Look at the artists who have duetted with Willie Nelson. It's a list of hundreds. Maybe, I mean, I hesitate to say, like, does it reach the thousands? Just because it is so many artists. I mean, it's and that kind of bleeds into the next category, which is artistry slash skill. He's such a complete, not just songwriter, but singer, but artist. He's received every possible award leading up to the Rock Hall. I mean, Kennedy Center Honors, Gershwin Prize, Library of Congress gave him a lifetime award. He's on these Rolling Stone lists of songs and albums, but he's also on their lists of great guitarists and great singers. It just feels like, regardless of genre, he's widely understood as authentic.
Authentic is a word that, it's not a loaded phrase. It's really, you can't buy authenticity. Willie's authentic. And, you know, as far as the range, I think of Casey Musgraves and Snoop Dogg are both in his yes. orbit.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Totally.
And they both recorded with him recently. So,
Last category is, does my mom know who he is? I mean, Willie Nelson has been one of the most famous people alive for a very long time. Absolutely. Almost everybody knows who Willie Nelson is. And that's maybe the most important category. And when we look at these artists on the ballot, and, you know, there's a case to be made for everybody on this ballot this year. But when it comes down to it, often if you want to be a betting man and look at who's going to be inducted, you go with who has the biggest name recognition. And Willie has far and away the biggest name recognition on this ballot.
I look at the list and who's the one name superstar.
Yeah, right? he's the Dolly of this year. He's the shoe-in. He's the gonna, there's no doubt, no question, it's gonna happen of this
year.
Well,
I mean, let's do our verdict then. Let's we're there. We're already saying it. So should he
My
be
verdict
the,
is you better.
Should he be in the hall? Will he get in and will it be this year? I mean, I think we're all in agreement, yes, on every count. And I would say, you know, Kristen and I were kind of on the fence for the should, because of the things we mapped out earlier about the hall
it's
establishing
more just,
its
if
boundaries.
If I didn't know anything about the hall, if I hadn't spent a stupid amount of time talking about it, good God, why? But like, if I, as a layperson, I'd be like, yeah, sure. And also, if you had talked to me 5 years ago, I would have said, sure, whatever, who cares, put whoever in, I don't care. But my only concern is just now, do we have to crowd the backlog? I think it's going to be very fun
issue.
To have Willie Nelson at the ceremony this year. I think it's going to be or next year, I guess it's going to be a continuation
of this year.
It'll be a continuation of his 90th birthday celebration. It's going to be an event. It's very well-timed.
It's
I understand.
Best interests, like
exactly.
You shouldn't
like
worry about the backlog. I mean, that's like, you know, that's your second guessing. It's like, should this person be in or not? Yes or no. Worry about the other part. That's for someone else to worry about.
No,
well,
but the
unfortunately,
thing is, we record
I am the
every week.
Who,
we record an
who
hour
worries
every week.
About the rest
We're the ones who
now.
Have the time to worry about this stuff. If no one else.
Well, Waylon should be right behind him. I'll say that. And Merle, Chris, I don't know, maybe.
Are you talking about Chris Gaines? I'm kidding.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see where the hall goes after this. Because, you know, is this a trend or is this, you know, they're getting two
right.
Two
is
icons.
This are they just getting back to back iconic big name performers that
us.
Are going to bring in some great guests and bring in new relevant artists as well, get everybody excited to perform with them. And that is something that Willie brings. And just thinking about him as like a kind of, you know, rebellious figure in country music, that's very rock and roll, an outlaw, outlaw country, all that stuff. I came into this ready. I knew, I've been saying it for weeks, we'll do this episode, I'll change my mind. And I did, of course, because obviously he is like, I can't make an equal argument because I was so pro Dolly, you know, but the one thing I kept saying with Dolly was this doesn't set a precedent. She's special. She's Miles Davis. Uh-huh. It doesn't mean we have to get everybody else in like this is that. And so I'm hoping that maybe this is just more another equally big icon.
Willie shared managers with Miles Davis.
Wow.
They had the same manager early on. So
what a roster.
You know, when you say Miles, Willie's on that level. And mm-hmm. when you say Dolly, Willie's on that level. And so I wouldn't worry about what the aftermath, other than to say my hope is that when you think of the macro world of rock and roll, that it's as inclusive of this country end as it is on the rhythm and blues end, on soul end.
Agreed.
And country and Western, rhythm and blues is what made rock and roll. And you got to acknowledge all that, you know, where it came from. And these are branches, but they're all intertwined. Mm-hmm. So if it doesn't happen, I don't know.
I'll be surprised.
I'll be surprised. It's happening.
I wouldn't worry about it.
I would say the chances are he's got the best odds of anyone on the ballot. Mm-hmm. Any artist, he's like
the favorite. He's the favorite.
The favorite, exactly.
Now, so let's just say he gets in this year. Who should give the speech to induct him? There's a long list of people who could do it. You could go the Snoop Dogg route, which is almost funny in its novelty.
I will also say you bring in the Snoop Dogg route because Snoop is not on, he hasn't been on a ballot and he's not in the hall yet.
Which
and
we see
he
the
is
hall
someone
do.
Who is coming to, like they often do that.
His time will come very
have
soon.
The person, and... Exactly. He's about to get in the next year or two, regardless. I can't believe no one drafted him. I guess we all just knew it wasn't happening yet, but like I would say he's getting in
it's
the
coming.
Next 2 years. I would be very surprised. So that would be like a good moment
layup.
Like that's a good layup, exactly.
But then there's also, you know, there's artists like Neil Young, and he's inducted a lot of people. He hasn't been to the ceremony in a long time, but you know, the connection with Willie is strong. Farm Aid, and you know,
Willie's kids are playing in Crazy Horse now.
Oh wow. I mean, so
that's a pretty deep connection there. And of course there's the Farm Aid connections of
Mellencamp or Dave Matthews
and John Mellencamp, their old buddies. I don't know. How do you,
it's, you know, the kind of the new Dave Grohl, which is the term we use for the kind of industry person that the hall loves to use, is Brandi Carlile.
She's
the last 2 years, she's played a prominent role.
Willie connects, they're tied.
Yeah.
I would say I would probably propose Sheryl Crow if I didn't think she was also
if she's
going to
get in.
Year.
Yeah.
Because she has played with Willie many times. She's been at every birthday celebration.
She has done many, many, many duets. How many was it? 13?
It was a lot. When we tallied them up, it was close to 10.
The only person Willie has not duetted with that he wanted to duet with is Barbara Streisand.
Interesting.
Ooh. Everyone else he's kind of made the list. I mean, they've done it.
Wow.
So, they're all good intros. And I think that's kind of a business decision or who looks best and who's going to be.
You are right about that.
Totally. It's a market. You need the marketing.
And I don't
name.
Think Willie's going to be making that decision, nor will his manager, Mark Roth.
They'll have some input, I bet. Mm-hmm. But it might not fully come down to them. It'll be a collaboration between the producers of the ceremony.
You got to have so-and-so, because then you're going to say, well, what about?
Right.
And that's Willie's problem. Everybody's his friend.
Yep.
Well, you can bring a lot of those people in for the performance, because Willie will perform. He'll do three songs and, you know, he could do it by himself.
And it'll be a Carole King style. He's going to bring out everybody, or a Dolly style, where it'll just be like him.
Say he's going to headline the ceremony and they will do a jam at the end with a lot of people. And I would say likely doing On the Road Again.
Go watch some YouTube of this summer's past summer's Outlaw tour. It was a big package tour, and that's how every show would end up. And Willie would be leading, you know, 30 people on stage. That's that's Willie's way.
Right. Yeah, it's going to happen.
But if you had to pick a 3-song set that in kind of encapsulated his career, and maybe, you know, sometimes with an artist like this, they might try to appeal to the rock crowd a little bit, but sometimes not.
They might even write a song specially about how
that the Dolly wrote a rock song specifically for the occasion, which was very cute.
Yeah, I'd want to hear On the Road Again.
Yeah, I think it's a given.
I also want to hear Bloody Mary Morning, because it's such a jam that everybody could get their lead.
It's a Bloody Mary Morning, baby, left me without warning sometime in the night.
Everybody on stage.
Sure. Yeah. I know Willie likes to open his concerts with Whiskey River.
Whiskey River, take my mind.
That's always a good one. Yeah, but also, you know, I like well, hello there, when he goes into Funny How Time Slips Away.
My, it's been a long, long time.
But you know what? I would guess, knowing what he does on his stage shows now, the rouser at the end of the set is I'll Fly Away, which is an old spiritual song.
Yeah.
That would be a good one to lead. You can lead a bunch of people in that song. Everybody singing. That's, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's also like got very gospel roots on it. So it really is going to depend on kind of like the makeup of the crowd on stage.
And who's there, who's presenting, if we happen to have some really solid soul singers.
Soul singers, exactly. Incorporate.
Well, I would try to bring those out. And again, it's like Al Green doing Funny.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That knocked my socks out to see it again.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for joining us. This was such a great talk. You were the perfect person, I think, to talk Willie with. So we appreciate you taking the time. I want to give you the opportunity to plug whatever you want. I mean, the book is Willie Nelson, An Epic Life. You've also got the radio show. So plug away, my friend.
That's it. Look, I'm a writer. I'm doing contract writing right now for Texas Highways Magazine. You can find me in the 50th anniversary of Texas Monthly Magazine. And every Saturday night, 7 to 9 Central, the Texas Music Hour of Power on Marfa Public Radio and Wimberley Valley Public Radio.
Can we access that online? I would imagine, yes.
Yeah, perfect. MarfaPublicRadio.org, WimberleyValleyRadio.org. Easy to find, 7 to 9 Central, so whatever your time is. And you can actually find that my every week show is on my homepage of joenickp.com.
Ooh. Excellent. Well, that's
thank
great.
You.
And I'm sure some of our listeners will check that out. And of course, our listeners know they can follow us at Rock Hall Pod on Twitter and Instagram. RockHallPod@gmail.com is the email. If you want Kristen to see your message, you need to say that somewhere, because otherwise she doesn't want to read it. And we made a pact that I would not share it with her unless you say her name. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts. Rate and review us 5 stars only. Anything less than 5 would be rude. Thank you to Mike Lloyd for the logo. Thank you to Yusu Kim for the music. And thank you to Pantheon Podcasts for hosting us. I'm Joe Quazala.
I'm Kristen Studdard.
And who cares
about the Rock Hall? ? Including country western.
As of now.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.